Okay, thank you. So, the time is the 6th century BC, and as a punishment for their sins, and especially for their idolatry, the Jewish nation has been exiled to Babylon, or at least some of them have. The nation's been invaded, some of them have been taken off to Babylon. In subsequent years, many more will actually join them. But within this unfaithful nation, there is always a remnant. There are always people who are committed and faithful to God. And four of them, so they arrive, Daniel and his three friends arrive, and we see there how they behave within Babylon. We see firstly that they diplomatically make a stand on the issue of food and drink, and then they accept new names, and they enroll in a new university course, or at least the equivalent of a university course. And they excel. And at the end of this time, these four, the nearest analogy, is that they've become fast-track entrants in the Babylonian civil service. And in the first chapter, we're actually reminded that history is in reality God's story, his story. In verse 2, we saw how God delivered the nation of Israel into the hands of the Babylonians. We saw how in verse 9, God gave the chief official, Ashpenaz, an attitude of favor towards Daniel, and how Daniel was able to make this stand on the issue of food and drink. And then we saw in verse 17 how God had given special knowledge and understanding to Daniel and his friends. And Daniel had a special understanding of dreams and visions as well. And in this chapter, God is once again the prime mover. It's he who gives this dream to Nebuchadnezzar. He uses Daniel to both reveal and interpret it. And his purposes are fulfilled as Daniel and his friends are promoted within Babylon. So four Jewish young men come to positions of power and responsibility, and God uses them in the coming times. So we come to chapter 2. And actually, David Suchet read out and he just said, in the second year. If you look back at the original Hebrew, there's an and there. Possibly we've been told not to start our sentences with and. Maybe that's why it isn't there, I don't know. But what it does show is the connections that it makes with the rest of the book. And I think that's the intention in the original language. Verse 2 spoke about the articles from the temple, if you look back at chapter 1 and verse 2. And they are referred to again in chapter 5, when the Babylonian Empire falls to the Medes and Persians. And then in verse 8, where Daniel makes a diplomatic stand on the issue of food and drink, again things come to the fore, because in chapter 3, Daniel's three friends are thrown into the fiery furnace, and in chapter 6, Daniel finds himself in the lion's den, simply for praying to God. Past experience and our reactions to it can prepare us for what happens in the future, as it did for these four young men. And then, of course, Daniel's insight into dreams and visions comes to the fore in this chapter and again in chapter 4 as well. Now, we also see that this is the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. And if you look carefully, you have to actually think very carefully before you can reconcile that with the fact that he met with them after 3 years of training. And actually what tended to happen in Babylon was that there was an inaugural year. So it's likely that Daniel and his friends arrived in this inaugural year, or year zero if you like. Computer people like to start from zero rather than one. And so at the end of the second year, that's when the university course is completed. And therefore this is when this happens. So this is very soon after they have just graduated from their training. And the section from 1, verses 1 to 13, set up the drama and the danger. It's soon after the graduation of Daniel and his friends. And some background history may help here. In 604 BC, Ashkelon, which was a distant province of Babylon, rebelled. And the Babylonians had to put down that rebellion. And that a lot of that place had been reduced to rubble. In 603 BC, we know that a large expeditionary force from Babylon was out in the field. And this may well explain why Nebuchadnezzar's mind was troubled. He was the emperor of a huge worldwide concern. He's still new to the role. He's feeling perhaps the weight of responsibility for his empire. Perhaps like Solomon, he's thinking, what sort of legacy am I going to leave? Despite all this great wealth and power, despite the fact that later on the wise men say, O king, live forever, that is not going to happen. And he may have been pondering the purpose of life and existence. How long would his empire last? How would he be remembered in history? And Solomon worked through those questions with the benefit of knowing God. For Nebuchadnezzar, things were much more complicated because he lived in a polytheistic society. And we know from events later on in this chapter, it was God who gave Nebuchadnezzar this dream as a revelation and a partial answer to his innermost thoughts. And then, of course, the problem is Nebuchadnezzar's reaction. Of course, he's probably quite irritable. He may have had this dream several times. He's losing sleep. He certainly must have suspected that the dream somehow concerned him, mustn't he? Maybe he was afraid it signaled the end of his kingdom. After all, there's this big rock knocking all these things down. And if that becomes widely known, perhaps somebody will try and hasten those events. And God had in Joseph's time given Pharaoh dreams about the future. Within our own lifetimes, we know there have been witnesses from people in remote parts of the world where they have had dreams and visions, where there was no other witness to them. We shouldn't routinely attribute every dream to God. It's part of our natural cycle of existence. But sometimes, maybe God is speaking. And then in verses 2 to 13, we see the failure of those men. The Babylonian Department of Dreams cannot interpret the dream. There are different views about why he asks his council of wise men to reveal the dream and then give the interpretation. Certainly a bit unusual, one might think. Some people have suggested they'd actually forgotten it. If that was the case, Nebuchadnezzar probably interpreted this. God was angry with him in giving him a dream and not even allowing him to remember it. But actually, if we look at the subsequent text, it's more likely, more logical, that Nebuchadnezzar would have actually wanted them to reveal the dream and been able to recognize they were doing it correctly. Otherwise, why bother asking them in the first place? Seems much more likely, in view of his distress over it, that he was a bit suspicious of the wise men, and some of the text actually supports that view as well, doesn't it? He wanted to test them. And there were apparently dream manuals of that time. They've actually been found. You know, this is the dream. This is what it means. And so these wise men, or whatever we choose to call them, would probably have just parroted back the generally accepted version of why and what it meant. And then many of them were associated with the many temples in Babylon as well. Supposedly, one would have thought, in touch with the gods that they worshipped. So although his request on a human level seems totally unreasonable, in his mind, it may have been just more like a difficult test. I've got all these people, presumably he's paying them loads of money for their services. I want to be sure that they're actually performing their jobs well. Now, just as an aside, from verse 4b of chapter 2 of Daniel until the end of chapter 7, it's in a different original language. It's in Aramaic. The reason's not entirely clear, but it's probably because all those events there generally relate not to the Jewish nation, but to the Gentiles. But in any event, the wise men have their response. It's unsurprising they want to know what the dream was. They can then go to their manuals and say, they'll be aware. And Nebuchadnezzar won't do it. And he puts it quite boldly, doesn't he? If you don't tell me, you're doomed. If you do tell me, I'll give you more or less anything you want. And in verses 10 and 11, if you look at them, it's very interesting. They effectively deny that they have any contact with the gods. It's an interesting comment on pagan theology of the time. They imply that the king is being entirely unreasonable And that's probably not a very wise thing to do to somebody who has the power and death over you. So his reaction in ordering these mass executions is hardly surprising. So the initial transition of Daniel and his friends into what was clearly for them a second-choice world suddenly becomes very threatening. And we all live in a second-choice world. Can anybody say of their life that I live exactly where I want to, that I have exactly the friends that I want, I have exactly this that I want? No, we can't. We all live in a second-choice world, and sometimes it becomes a bit threatening. And clearly Daniel and his friends were not at this original meeting with Nebuchadnezzar, but they're included in this command to be put to death. Not exactly fair. And verses 14 to 24 are all about how Daniel and his friends react. He's calm under the shock and pressure of what's happened. Instead, he shows wisdom and tact. It says that specifically in the passage. He tries to understand why this command has been given, understand how much time he might have, understand how he can influence the outcome. And then we see also, in contrast to chapter 1, where he declined the king's food and drink and tried not to be involved, here he immediately gets involved. He's concerned, I'm sure, for all of those who stand under the threat of execution, not just himself. And we can see here in microcosm a way in which the nation of Israel actually blesses those around. Because if Daniel weren't there, these people would have died. That's for sure. The fact that he wasn't at that meeting probably indicates that though he was a fast entrant, he didn't have enough seniority to be called before the king, I guess. And seniority still counts for a lot sometimes, even though it's not always justified that it does. But Arioch will have known about him. And so Daniel can go to Arioch. He's probably had some conversations with Arioch, who was the captain of the guard in the past, for various reasons. Probably he's taken time to listen to Arioch, to establish some kind of working relationship. And then he persuades Arioch to take a risk, really, and give Daniel a chance to redeem the situation. It's not explicitly stated in the passage, but it's fairly probable that Arioch arranged for Daniel to see Nebuchadnezzar. You didn't just walk in to the presence of an empire in those days. We know that happens from the story of Esther as well. Even she, who was married to the top dog, as it were, couldn't just walk in and see him. So Arioch has probably helped that arrangement. And perhaps by this time, things have calmed down. And Daniel wasn't at that previous meeting, so Nebuchadnezzar's calmed down. He thinks, well, he wasn't there. Let's give him a chance, perhaps. And the conversation, no doubt, was conducted again with tact and wisdom. And Daniel gets the time that he asked for. And I don't suppose, Brian, that when you chose the verses that you quoted to us earlier, you particularly had this in mind, did you? You didn't. But maybe God did. Read again. Go back after the service and look at those verses and see how they might apply to Daniel. They apply so much. Because what does he do after this? He has this prayer meeting. So it might be regarded as the first Babylonian student prayer meeting. Or perhaps as they graduated, we should call it a graduate prayer meeting. He doesn't go it alone. He wants the support of his three friends there. And that the prayer that they have is believing prayer, but it's not demanding prayer. Daniel is convinced that God can answer it, but he's not presumptuous. He is asking. God knows the situation. God and Daniel is bringing it to him. We don't have a timetable for that situation. As it says in the night, I think we can assume that it wasn't just 5 minutes and here you are, here's the answer. It was probably some hours. The text even allows a possible interpretation that Daniel dreamed the same dream. And whether totally by revelation or partly by exercise of his God-given ability, Daniel is also enabled to understand the interpretation. He's given the understanding, isn't he, that God is always in control. And he no doubt felt a profound sense of relief, wouldn't you, in those situations? And yet, his first reaction is praise. There's one verse given to the fact that he's received the interpretation, and four verses given to Daniel's response in praise. He's still got to go in and tell the king, convince him. But that would also have been the subject of prayer. No doubt his three friends continued in prayer. And Daniel must have been confident that Nebuchadnezzar would listen. Now, the controlling theme of this whole chapter is certainly revelation. There are 25 instances where the words that we would translate as reveal, show, or make known are in fact used. So we come to the interpretation. But first note Daniel's concern for all the wise men. It's not clear earlier, but it's clear here. He's asking, don't execute the wise men of Babylon. Now, of course, Harriot claims a bit of credit for himself here, doesn't it? I found him, whereas Daniel actually went to him. But I'm sure that Daniel didn't mind that at all. And Harriot probably arranged for the interview in the first place. Now, verse 26 may cast some doubt on Nebuchadnezzar's belief that Daniel can interpret the dream, but that soon disappears as Daniel relates what has happened. And Daniel's clear that he doesn't take personal credit here. He effectively witnesses to Nebuchadnezzar about God in the same sort of way that Paul does in Athens when he talks about the unknown God. There's even that preamble. He tells the king what he was thinking about before the dream. And Daniel clearly declares clearly that both the dream and the interpretation are part of God speaking to the king about the future. So Daniel reveals the dream. It's a mainly straightforward interpretation, really. It does involve, though, the fall of Babylon. Not only the fall of Babylon, but the complete destruction of Babylon. There's nothing left of Babylon to this day. So in human terms, that was a very bold thing to do. You thought he might have softened it or tried to get around it, but he made no attempt to do that. He trusted God to handle any fallout in that situation. He was faithful and they trusted God. His whole presentation is God-centered, despite the situation having some parallels, I think, between Elijah before Jezebel and Jesus before Pilate. Look at verse 37, for example. Go through some of those things there. So Daniel says that Nebuchadnezzar has his position courtesy of God. God has given it to him. You don't deserve it. You've been given it. And the tradition of that time did talk about four great empires with differing characteristics. And interestingly, if you look at the statue and the metals that are involved, the atomic weights decline as you go down, but the hardness of the metal increases. It says something about the different nature of those empires as well. And actually, they last longer. The Babylonian Empire is the shorter one here. The Eastern Roman Empire apparently isn't generally thought to have completely disappeared until 1453. So that's a very long time indeed. We can identify the silver chests as the Medes and Persians. Daniel lived to see that. Look at Daniel chapter 5. That's when the Medes and Persians conquered Babylon. The bronze part represents the Greek Empire, founded by Alexander the Great and then handed on to his generals, and iron and clay must be about the Roman Empire. But the important point is the rock. The rock represents God's intervention in history in the person of Jesus and in the rise of Christianity. Nothing is left of the rest. Now, of course, we have had empires in a sense since then, and the interesting thing about some of that is the clay mixed with the iron. It can be problematical, but perhaps it says something about the moral defects of all human society. We've had sort of the British Empire and various other empires, but there was an awful lot that wasn't right and wasn't good that went on in those times. And after a while, they always decline, don't they? They never stay. Even in our age of great technology, great wealth, there are estimated by Tier Fund to be nearly 700 million people each day who go hungry. We don't have other basics. We're paying through the nose for water. It's Sorry, I've got a bit of a thing about that. And we take and crime and antisocial behaviour are rife even in our society, which we would regard as relatively peaceful. God has already intervened for us. It was in the future for Daniel. And so Nebuchadnezzar recognises his dream. He recognises that it's a true interpretation. And he must have been amazed when Daniel told him his thoughts prior to the dream as well. And when he responds in the way that he does. Oops, sorry. He's referring, it's telling that Nebuchadnezzar is actually referring to other gods. So he recognizes something amazing has happened here. But he's still at heart a polytheist, despite this experience. But the important point is it's a beginning. Things continue in chapter 3 and chapter 4. And Nebuchadnezzar is gradually drawn to the realization of who God is and how he should respond to him. But his response here at this particular time is to put Daniel in a very high position indeed. It's unclear as to, if you think of the UK, if you think of the king as being Nebuchadnezzar, whether Daniel's been promoted to be prime minister or just the mayor of London. But it's certainly the equivalent of one of those. Either he's the second in charge over the whole empire, or he's been put in charge of the central province of Babylon. And then his three friends are also given positions of power and responsibility. But Daniel remains at the royal court. And all four of them will have been strengthened for future trials that they would face. Jeremiah 29, verses 5 to 7, records how Jeremiah had written to the exiles in Babylon and told them what to do. He told them to seek the welfare of the place where they were. So, how does this apply to us today? Well, it tells us something about God and the way that he reacts and he's in control of things. We should be encouraged by that. It's not just the present, but also the future. And we sometimes forget when we call God our Father, our friend, our Saviour, and so on, and that we remember we're made in his image, which we are, that he's still very different, that he's still the ruler of the universe. He created the earth on which we stand. He can respond to prayers of billions of people simultaneously. His ways and thoughts are higher than ours. 1,000 years is as a day. A day is as 1,000 years. There are numerous prophecies or visions of future events in the Bible, and we should not attempt to over-rationalize them. We may not be able to fully or definitively understand how they work, but human kingdoms rise and fall. God's kingdom goes on. He sees and hears all. His ways and thoughts are higher. We can't understand everything, but we can understand that only God's kingdom is internal. Only this rock that has destroyed everything else is going to last. Now, I'll just have a little aside now on prophecy. Some people are more into prophecy than others and give it more importance. That doesn't particularly matter. But when you think about prophecy and God knowing the future, how do you think that actually happens? People have different views. But an interesting thing in the Bible is it says, I can't remember the reference, but it says that God is able to do more than we ask or think. So I couldn't find a Star Trek example. But I could find a couple of interesting things from an author, science fiction author called Isaac Asimov. Interestingly, he was a Jew. He was a Russian immigrant to the United States. He became professor of biochemistry, but he gave it up at the relatively early age of 38 when he had a breakthrough in writing some very popular science fiction. And he had these ideas. So I just want to give you two ideas that he had, which might give us a flavor of just how God is in control and how he sees things. So the first one was the famous series called The Foundation Trilogy. And in it, his alter ego develops something called psychohistory, a very complicated mathematical way of predicting how large populations of human beings will behave. And therefore, they use that for good. They try and break down the, they try and shorten the time between different empires and so on. And, but also behind the scenes, you find out in the second book that there's not just one foundation that's been established, who are basically concentrating on physical things and science. There's a second foundation which concentrate on the mind, and they have the power to intervene. And if things are going a little bit off, they intervene in history and they put it back on course. So one way of looking at it might be God is so powerful, so all-knowing, that he can see within boundaries what's going to happen. And if anything is going off course, he'll intervene, and we know he's intervened. The other one is possibly more interesting, or simpler anyway, is he wrote a book called The End of Eternity. And in this book, he envisages that sometime, I think in the 27th century, people develop the ability to pull themselves out of time altogether. And they have a whole community of people who call themselves the Eternals, who live outside of time. They don't live forever, they're still human beings, and they pop into different centuries and start fiddling with history and correcting it for the good of all mankind. But the point there is that they are seeing time from outside. And that's quite a popular and simple, probably the view that I would favour, of how God can do prophecy. But he certainly also works in time as well. So these things are significant. We don't have to dot all the I's and T's of exactly how they work. But, you know, if you need to have some kind of view of how this is feasible, how it could possibly be, then there are two examples that were imagined by a human being. So how much more could God do? One other amusing thing, which there's a film called Goodbye Lenin. I expect Teresa's seen it. The Berlin Wall fell very quickly, didn't it? Most people couldn't see that coming. And there's a film in which a woman has an accident just before the Berlin Wall falls. And then she wakes up out of a coma just after the Berlin Wall has fallen. And her family are so concerned about the shock that this will be for her that they try and hide from her the fact that it's happened. Even when a giant statue of Lenin is going by outside the hospital ward where she is, it's very amusing. But let me just conclude by asking us through that. We're not puppets on a string. God understands and sees much more than we can. God acts. History is his story. God's relationship with time, however we believe it is certainly different from ours. So let's think about how we are challenged by this whole thing. Okay, I've got all three on that. Right. So, firstly, we should be involved, as Daniel was involved. And that means that we have to build relationships and friendships, not just with other believers, but also with others. Daniel established that relationship with Ashpenaz, his guard, in chapter 1, with Arioch in chapter 2, and of course Nebuchadnezzar to an extent in both of them. It was important for God, the outworking of God's purpose, that he had those relationships. So we must ask ourselves, are we using our time to build up friendships and relationships, not just with people in the church, with people outside? Are we seeking to know how much time we should spend to people? Our time is limited. Are we seeking God to say, should I pursue this friendship or that one? How should I respond in this situation? Are we just making our own choices, or are we coming to God? Secondly, the importance of prayer. Daniel didn't just sit down and try and reason out and think through, what did Nebuchadnezzar dream? No. It wasn't likely to be successful, was it? And he probably suspected straight away that God was somehow involved. And the situation there, of course, is urgent and threatening. And so they turn to that. But Daniel uses reason in asking questions. Why has this happened? How much time do I have? What can be done? And having given time, he immediately seeks God about the situation. And let's be clear that reason and revelation are in different categories of things. We are given revelation by God, but we are also given reason, and we can reason about revelation as well. And there's no reason why we should not do that. In our world, what should we be doing? Well, we don't have to wait to see what is going on in the world. We have everything on our doorsteps. We have it through our television screens. We can tell what is happening in the world at large. And so we can turn to prayer for things on a regular basis, for all the things that are going wrong in our world. But it should be, yeah, corporate prayer, but there's also personal prayer. It's not in this chapter, but if you look forward to Daniel chapter 6, we see that Daniel went up to three times a day, opened the windows of his apartment, which pointed towards Jerusalem, and he prayed. And he did that even when he was forbidden to do so, and as a result ended up in the lion's den. And then thirdly, we need to give credit to God for all that he does in our lives. Be bold in our witness. Take the opportunities we have. Daniel certainly does that as he interprets that dream for Nebuchadnezzar. He trusts God to then work in the king's life. Sometimes it takes time. Arguably, after Nebuchadnezzar's return, after 7 years basically living as an animal in chapter 4, he had actually come to know and to trust God. We can't be sure from the text, but it's quite likely, I think. And we must trust God's timing in our lives, but also in the lives of other people. So to summarize, God's in control of the present and the future. We are to be involved in our second choice worlds as we relate to him, as we pray, as we give the credit to him, as we take our opportunities for witness, and as we trust in God's timing. And I'd like to encourage you to go back to Philippians, read those two verses again, see how that reacts with it. And then I've got just something to think about, which is what I cobbled together, which is why I've got those credits, because it's two different things that I read, but I thought they fitted together. Daniel lived at the source of fury and turmoil and stared it down because he glanced at the problems, but he gazed at God. Amen.